Welcome to SFCT. You're listening to a podcast of a presentation given at the Orienting Solutions Conference held in October 2013 at the University of Hertfordshire. For more information, go to www.asfct.org. This presentation is by SFWorks' Mark McCurgo on solution-focused and active and narrative. The action is in the interaction.
Hello there, it's Mark McCurgo here from SFWork and also a visiting research fellow at the University of Hertfordshire. This is the first talk from the Orienting Solutions 2013 conference. I gave it, of course, live in the event and we recorded it there. Unfortunately, the first minute and a half or so was missed off the recording. So this is me filling in what I would have said, or what I did say rather, in the first minute and a half. I would have introduced the session as being called Solution Focused, Inactive and Narrative, the Actions in the Interaction. This event is a world first. It's the very first academic conference focusing on research in and academic work in solution focused and narrative and inactive practices. There have been many practitioner conferences thus far, the famous EBTA conferences, SolWorld, UK ASFP and so on. Meetings are focused on developing practitioners and practitioner sharing with not so much in the way of academic work. And this is the first really academically focused event that we've had for a very long time, if ever at all. It's also the first time we're bringing the inactive paradigm into this arena. Dan Hutter will be speaking after me about the inactive paradigm. And it's a Wittgenstein-inspired development on mind, philosophy of mind, and how mind is not a controlling thing in the brain, but very much enacted in embodied behavior and so forth. I think it's very coherent with SF work, and I look forward to hearing what you think later on. Also, we're here at the University of Hertfordshire at Hatfield, and thanks to them, they're world leaders in the inactive and Wittgensteinian philosophy in the Department of Philosophy. They also, in the Department of Nursing and Social Work, ran the first UK university-based SF therapy module back in 1995, which was run by Dave Hawkes. And so they have pedigree in both of these fields, which is why I think this is an ideal venue to be holding this meeting, and they've been very supportive in helping us put it on and organise it. So solution-focused practice, the roots of SF practice are in the interactional brief therapy tradition, which goes back to the Mental Research Institute in the 1960s. And we have Janet Bavalos with us here, who was working at the MRI in those days, of course, was the author of Pragmatics of Human Communication. It's around talking about mental illness, if you like, as patterns of communication rather than internal disorders. And the MRI were the first to look at how do you change, by changing people's patterns of interaction, communications, you can change their lives and they can rid themselves of what's been troubling them. A very novel way in the 1960s of thinking about mental illness, and still a novel way today. Solution-focused practice was very much built on those foundations, developed, as many of you will know, by Steve DeShazer and Insoo Kim Berg at the Brief Family Therapy Center in Milwaukee in the 1980s and developing through into the 2000s, with Steve's death in 2005 and Insoo's death in 2007. And we're very pleased to have Gail Miller joining us here at the conference. Gail was the in-house researcher as a sociologist at the BFTC, spent a long time there watching what they were doing, working with Steve and Insoo, and was connected in a very, very unique way to that work around about that time. We might say that solution-focused practice is about minimalism meets pragmatism, and that for all the things that we don't worry about in this minimal and pragmatic form, over to me on the day. One of the things is don't worry about diagnosis, causes, underlying issues, psychological mechanisms, and worrying about those for the therapist all seems to make therapy slower, in my view. And in a moment I'll say what you do worry about, but in use all over the UK, all over the world, in organisations, in schools, in therapy, in social work, in vast number of different fields. As I get to go first, I'll sort of lay out my view of what solution-focused therapists do and what they don't normally do at all. This is taken from the paper I wrote with Harry Corman in 2009. Solution-focused therapists do focus on what the client and others involved want and what they say they want, taking that seriously, what difference that would make to their ordinary daily activities. And they don't normally focus on what's wrong and why. They do ask about what helps the client progress in the direction they want, and they don't normally ask what stops or blocks the client. They do normally use the client's description of what they want and what this is when this is already happening to help everybody involved decide what's useful for the client to do more of. They don't normally diagnose pathology or use theories to understand what's going wrong in clients' lives. They do listen very carefully to what clients say, believing that in the words themselves there lies everything necessary for clients to find and build solutions. Solution-focused therapists following Steve DeShazer's lead of talking about this as staying on the surface, taking the words and working with them and not worrying about whatever might be going on behind. So we don't normally assume that what's left unsaid or what is deemed to be underneath or behind the words is more interesting or significant than what is actually said. It's right there in front of you. And finally, we do use simple and concrete language to build on the client's descriptions, and we don't normally introduce abstract, mentalistic or systemic language into the conversations or indeed your thinking at any stage during the therapy process. So that's a very... we'll hear a lot more about these kind of distinctions. Just to draw the connection then with narrative practice emerged around the same time as solution-focused practice. Michael White and David Epstein from Australia are generally acknowledged, I think, as the founders of this. Key book was Narrative Means to Therapeutic Ends. These two things emerged in actually the same issue of the same journal, had the two key papers, one from DeShazer and co. and one from White and co. And so I think for various pragmatic reasons they had to differentiate themselves from each other. Otherwise they would have been had difficulty selling their services and so forth. So, but I think many people are thinking that solution-focused and narrative are really brothers in many ways. So narrative practice, similarly around working with the language of the client and being very respectful towards that language, but focusing on finding and thickening traces of a positive, useful narrative in the client's life, and not thickening the problematic narratives that have been frequently dominating the client's life to that point, leaving those problem narratives to wither and die from disuse, rather than trying to actively stop them or get rid of them. Also, narrative therapy includes quite a lot of interesting witnessing practices where other people who face similar situations are brought around to tell their stories and the client listens and responds to them. And that's something with reflecting teams that more and more solution-focused people are actually starting to draw on the similar things. So a little comparison between those two, some similarities. View of the client is expert in their own lives and wishes. It's not our job to think what people should do with their lives, it's our job to support them in living a healthy life. Therapist in a not knowing position, and this causes a lot of confusion. Not knowing about what the client should do, but being prepared to work with client and to build client's understanding of their own views on what they should do. Accepting and privileging the client language and taking a role in kind of guiding the conversations. You can't guide a conversation in all directions at once, and the conversational mechanism is one of conversational nudging, if you like. And there's a post-structural background to both of these practices, if one is needed. I think the narrative people are keener to embrace that background than the solution-focused people. Solution-focused people want to get on with the practice, really, without worrying too much about the theory. And both schools would say, I think, that the action's in the interaction. It's all happening in the conversation, in the work. It is the dialogue. The dialogue is not about the work. The work is the dialogue. A few distinctions between the two fields for me. So solution focus is very pragmatic, and narrative can sometimes appear more elaborate the way it's written about and spoken about. Narrative has an explicitly social constructionist kind of background to it. Solution focus, I think, has an implicit social constructionist background,
and perhaps a wider background in some ways, drawing back to Wittgenstein and other philosophers there. These are different traditions, and they have different norms and different, you know, these things have grown up over 25 years and more of two schools developing their own ways, but there is recent dialogue on more rapprochement. I know Guy Shenan was blogging about this, an issue of Journal of Systemic Therapies recently, where people were talking about we should be getting back together again. We have a lot in common, and I would second that. And indeed, Gail Miller and I, Gail's also here, have written about viewing solution-focused work as narrative emergence, as the emergence of proto-narratives, and I think that fits quite well for me with what we do. So lots of interesting possible connections. However, we're all facing a big problem. Both these practices demand a gentle not knowing and appreciation. To be good at doing it, you have to be very good at going slowly and gently. But if you want to make waves in academia, you need to be assertive and confident. And so to be assertive and confident about the benefits of being gentle and not knowing brings challenges of, you know, then you can be accused of the performative contradiction. In other words, not doing what you're saying very easily. Where there are other schools where being assertive and confident is both the medium and the message. And therefore, that's a much more straightforward offer in an academic ground. Which brings us towards, well, we want to be more assertive and confident, and we need to then start expanding our horizons a bit into what can we be confident about. Because you can't be confident about what your client should do. That would be ridiculous. But instead, we need to look more at what is the theory of these approaches, and this is a tricky business. What kind of theory are we talking about? People used to talk about there was no theory to solution focus. Steve DeShazer was insistent there was no missing theory. Solution focused as a practice was completely complete and didn't require a theory, even Wittgenstein. And it's a little bit as if some solution focused practitioners, and I sometimes have included myself in this, feel that if you start worrying about the theory, you're going to take your eye off the client and what they're doing. And so you have to stick your fingers in your ears every time anyone talks about theory and say, no, I can't hear you. because it might interfere with my practice. I hope that's not the case, because if that is the case, we're up a gum tree in these fields. If we want to make a more assertive academic case, we have to start considering this. But, however, solution-focused and narrative practice both work, clearly, and they work rather against expectations of the field of, you know, psychology and psychotherapy in many senses. So it's interesting to investigate it, and we shouldn't be afraid of investigating how these things work and what's going on and how we can talk about them in a good way. And some people have been doing that in small steps already. More recently, the Karlstadt group, which Bjorn Johansson founded, he would have been here, but he has a slipped disc and can't travel. And there are one or two people here who were in the Karlstadt group who was there, yes, a few were here. Started to consider this question, and then we had an SF summit in Malmo, and a few people again were here at that. And now we're at this point of connecting up with the Enactive school of thought, and I've been a visiting research fellow here for 3 years now, working with Dan and the philosophy department, learning about that and seeing the connections and introducing them, and I'm delighted to say we're all here together to try and see what we can make of those connections. So Dan will be talking much more about the Enactive position in just a moment, but let me just start it off. It's a post-Wittgensteinian position, I think. Although we say that here, Dan always tells me to hide Wittgenstein's name because he upsets philosophers who think they've already been heard quite enough about Ludwig and his works. They haven't, obviously, because they still don't accept it. But So go gently on the Wittgenstein. So the Enactive thing, though, can be traced back, I think, to the embodied mind work of Varela Thompson and Roche, very classic book, and this idea that mind is a property of something that is an embodied being, a person, in other words, or some other embodied thing. It's not just a computer in the background. The contrast it with the cognitive paradigm, cognitive paradigm says that you take in information through your senses, that's called perception, and then your brain does some sort of cognition work, which builds a representation of the world, which you then act on. You don't act on the real world, you act on the representation up here. That's a tiny summary of a cognitive position. The inactivist position is not that at all. It says there's no representation in here. The representation is the world, and we're engaging with the world and working with it. So thinking too much in mentalistic terms is a mistake. The brain is implicated. If you take somebody's brain out, they won't think very well. I think we can all probably agree on that. But there's more to thinking than the brain. And the brain is a part of the body, the environment, and so forth. And to privilege the brain's role in this is the same as to privilege the fingertip, you know, or the eyebrow. It gets muddled if you start privileging one part over another. So Dan Hutto here has been working on his narrative practice hypothesis, which is about mentalistic words and how we come to use mentalistic words as a way of understanding how people are. We say he believed the jam was in the cupboard, so he went to look for it. And that's just a way of talking about how people work. But if you then go too far and look for the belief in the brain that made him go and look in the cupboard, you're kind of going off down a confused and muddled path. So it's not wrong to talk in mentalistic terms, but it's wrong to think of mentalistic mechanisms. I'm summarising vast tracts of stuff here, and I'm sure Dan will be putting me right very soon. So these recent developments have been triggered in part by developments in artificial intelligence and robotics and other fields, where people have been trying to make robots that make representations of the world in their sort of memories, and finding that's incredibly difficult. And the representation seems to get in the way of the robot actually doing something. And so they've been exploring with this idea and having good success. And that's bringing it back onto the research agenda in a very multidisciplinary, very exciting way. And we had a fantastic conference, Foundations of Inactive Cognitive Science, last year, which brought together some people from there, I think, were at that. From that are here, and very fascinating work. And Dan will be talking a little bit in his session about narrative self-shaping, which is one of his new pieces of work, but seems to me to be very, very relevant to a lot of what we're doing here. And once again, one of the slogans of the inactive world is the action is in the interaction. So you need interactions to make things happen, not just single actions. So, why are we all here today? Check my time. Very briefly then. A colleague emailed on a listserv from the States. He had been invited to speak at a university by a group of students who wanted him to speak on solution-focused therapy. And he had an email back from the professor at the university saying, presently there is very little research evidence that solution-focused therapy is effective or that it's beneficial in helping people solve their personal problems. Unfortunately, too many of the psychotherapies that are provided have yet to be examined or shown to work. This does not mean that they do not work, instead it means that we really don't know that they are beneficial. Unfortunately, solution-focused therapy has yet to get the kind of research support that would put it into the category of evidence-based treatment. For that reason, I cannot extend an invitation to Elliot Connie to speak at the college sponsored by the graduate programme. So, pardon?
It's a polite way of turning down Elliot.
It was a very nice man, and he wouldn't be turned down like that. So the question I have for you is it that there is little evidence, or is it that I think I can safely ignore the evidence because it's coming from somewhere outside my radar? Or is it if I took the evidence seriously, I'd have to rethink my whole field, and I don't want to do that? And this is one of the central questions for this meeting for me. Is solution-focused and narrative work out in the cold? Yes, a little bit, academically. The vast majority of the developments in this field happen in practitioner circles, not within the academic discourse. So if academics are looking for academics working on it, they're struggling to find any. They are there, but they're usually working independently in a department surrounded by other people who work in different ways. The lack of focus of publications is another issue, and I think Alistair will be talking about this later on this morning. There are publications, but they come out scattergun in a billion journals, and there's no easy way of drawing them together, so there's no authoritative source for what's going on. There's no university-based centre or focus, so if academics are looking around for a university that's majoring this, they can't find one yet. There are questions about what counts as evidence, and one of the things we have here in the UK is that NICE, National Institute of Clinical Excellence, only counts evidence as high quality if it has a diagnostic category attached to it. And as our process doesn't involve a diagnostic category, any evidence that we produce coherently is deemed to be low quality because we're not playing by those rules. So it's a kind of catch-22. If you do your thing, you're outside the high quality. If you do the high quality thing, you're already breaking your own rules, your own methodology. It's a problem. Also, the solution-focused practice, I think, lies outside something that can be easily manualised. This is where, as Janet Bavalos, who I was interviewing yesterday, said, people want to manualise it, give it to a second-year graduate student, and then they can do experiments, because a second-year graduate student can read the manual out. And solution-focused practice and narrative practice is a thing that requires some skill. You can learn it fairly quickly, but there is some skill. And it's a bit like playing the piano in that regard. If you manualised playing the piano, gave it to a second-year graduate student and told them to get on with it, the results would be dreadful. But that doesn't mean that piano playing doesn't work. It means you're thinking about it in the wrong way. Okay. And finally, there is no good account of the mechanism. What is going on when we do solution-focused work? And as practitioners, we shy away from this idea of mechanisms. But if we want to be coherent, I think we have to have some story about what's going on that makes some sense to other people, to people outside our little zone. And I think that enactivism and narrative emergence perhaps have a part to play in that. So, finally, last slide. Some questions to put out there for this conference, and I'm hoping that we can come back to these in the last session with Raya and others. What counts as good evidence and good research in this field? And how can we, you know, expand that definition so that it sits more easily with other people's definitions of good evidence? How can we collect, package and distribute research so that it can no longer be ignored? Which might look like a research bulletin or something. How can we influence research activities and developments in this field, which might look like a research hub of some sort? And finally, how do we bring together developments in philosophy of mind and philosophy of psychology with the practical implications? And that means a cross-disciplinary setting, which is very much what we have here today, and what I'm hoping that we can continue with in some useful way by those who are up for it for this particular piece of interesting journey.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast. Please come back for more. Again, more information is available at www.asfct.org.